You count with this, man. Whatever it is, it ain't enough. Cause I need some more.
Money, trying to keep it in something ugly, can't be front and bumming. Dead presidents run the country, debit or credit. Pay for a plastic, whatever suits you. I'm used to never having enough.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Money and Values, a program about the changing value, but more importantly, about the changing nature of money. My name is Dave Adelson, and I'm speaking, as I usually do, with Max Frodwolf, an economist located in New York. Max, how you doing?
Not bad. Happy New Year to everyone, at least happier, which shouldn't be that hard to achieve. Nice to be on the conversation with you, in the conversation on the special holiday edition.
Yes, it's December 31st, 2008. We're looking at the end of a tumultuous and historic year. I hope you had a good holiday.
Well, I think my holiday was better than the holidays experienced by an awful lot of American retail stores, because it looks like this is going to be at least the worst year since 1970. And that could be revised to even worse, so the worst year since longer than 1970, just like this was, unfortunately, one of the worst years ever in most national stock markets around the world, and the worst year since 1931 for U.S. stocks. So that means the worst year for American 401ks, pensions, savings, blah, blah, blah. So
what's the impact of this terrible retail season on retailers? What are we going to be seeing in the coming months?
Well, a bit remains to be seen, because as it's generally the rule, right after tomorrow, or starting tomorrow more or less, starting on New Year's Day 2009, becomes the dead zone for retailers and restaurants, because January, February, March are pretty bad, with the exception maybe of a little blip for Valentine's Day. They're poor seasons anyway. And many of America's retailers limped badly wounded out of a Christmas in which they rely on for 20 to 30% of their profits and returns for the year. Looks like overall, the best estimates coming in now were that Americans spent around 3 to 3.5% less in 2008 on Christmas than they did in 2007. And that is at least the worst since 1970 and rather cataclysmic. Some of the forecasting models that I've looked at are suggesting between 25 and 45,000 stores around the country will fold in the next 3 months. And while there are millions of stores, that is an enormous number, and that means a lot of landlords not getting rent and employees not getting paychecks and lost jobs and unwritten rent checks and utility checks and unbought services, basically coast to coast and community after community. And there is, I think, a growing awareness that whole malls will likely fail as large anchor tenants in the mall business traditionally, and there are all different kinds of malls, but there are traditionally a few what are called anchor stores, and these would be the large national chains that occupy the sort of areas around entries and in corners in these malls and do a lot of the business and are the tenants that the mall as a real estate concern relies upon. And as we see a lot of national chains close many stores and some whole national chains go bankrupt, you're going to see malls that can't continue to function because they lose many tenants, including possibly the all-important anchor tenants.
And 3% doesn't sound like a lot, a 3% decline year over year, at least to somebody who's not trained in looking at numbers like this. How does 3%, a 3% dip, translate into such economic carnage?
Possibly because the way the economy that we have functions is very much is addicted to growth. And so lower growth is dangerous, and negative growth is always very painful.
Well, that brings me to what I was hoping to talk about today, which was some notions of deflation. I think inflation is much more familiar to many people, certainly to me, and I'd like to understand the process of deflation a little. And how it relates to economic contractions, what it does to economies. And then I was hoping maybe we could talk a little bit about how one steps on the money accelerator and what happens when the transmission or the engine of the car aren't in the condition to handle the increase in fuel that's being pumped in.
It's an interesting series of observations and questions. Part of the reason that you're not very familiar with deflation, nor am I in the practical sense, other than having studied it in its abstract form or the way it's showed up most recently and sort of famously in Japan, is that the United States hasn't had a significant sustained bout of deflation since the 1930s, which means that almost no living American has a, you know, adult comprehension experience of dealing with deflation. And what it is a sustained decline in the average price level. And in order to get it, you generally need a sudden decrease in one of two things, either a sudden decrease in the amount of purchasing power that people have, their ability to buy things. So there's tons of unsold inventory, whether that's cars or homes or stocks and bonds. You suddenly have a decline in the purchasing power, so people can't buy these things, and inventory builds up, and in a desperate competition to be one of the stores or one of the vendors who can sell things, different companies and vendors and producers compete with each other by slashing prices to lure in those remaining folks who can purchase. So it should sound a little bit to folks like what all the retailers were busy doing this Christmas season. It's quite dangerous. The other possibility, which occurs less frequently, is that people suddenly lose their appetite to purchase. And that can happen because people are very scared about the future and about how well prepared they are for it. For instance, that might happen in a population where you have very high debt levels and very low savings, and suddenly people start to think, the future isn't going to be as bright as they used to think it was. That should also sound familiar to those of us in this conversation, because that aptly describes the condition of the artist formerly known as the American middle class.
And could you talk, that leads to the idea of money velocity, and that's something that economists talk about all the time, I know, but I think non-economists aren't really familiar with the idea.
The velocity of money really just looks at the average number of times that the average dollar changes hands in a year. So the classic example would be if someone out there, or some of the folks out there listening to us, have some money that they buried in a bag in their yard or put in the cookie jar, that money may sit there for 3 years and have a zero velocity for 3 years. It's basically taken out of the economy. It's low-powered money or low-velocity money, because it isn't used for really anything other than sitting in the jar or buried in the yard, whereas a dollar that you might get from an ATM machine and then make a purchase on 5 minutes later, which ends up back in the same ATM machine, which was taken out by someone else, may have a velocity or a number of turnovers that's very high even in a single day or in a single week.
Well, but one way that that money in the backyard or in the mattress can have an effect on velocity is its effect on people's feeling of security. So once you get a certain amount of that stuffed away, so you feel able to sustain some kind of economic shock, then maybe additional dollars coming in will get spent.
Sure, but you would still have taken out some of the money from the financial and banking system of the country and reduce that money's velocity to zero.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that you were having a higher velocity and more normal turnover and activity with the rest of your money would still drag down the national average. Now, obviously, if you're talking about, you know, two people or a few people or a few folks in one town or one area, it wouldn't have a big footprint on the national statistics. But if you're talking about a general sense of insecurity, or a loss of faith in the banking system where people start to hoard money because they're afraid there'll be bank holidays or ATMs will be shut off, then you start to get a real serious situation where so much money gets taken out of circulation and hoarded that we need to start pumping out a lot more money to do the same amount of transactions because some of it we can't use.
So what does it mean when we're pumping out a whole lot of new money? I mean, a listener to this program asked me the question, how come we, i.e. the taxpayer, is giving Citibank, right? I guess that's a good point. You know, people say that the Fed is part of the government, but I understood that it was actually a cartel of private banks who have a standing agreement with the government about the money creation process. But the point is that Citibank is being given money both by the Treasury through the TARP and the Troubled Assets Relief Program, and by the Fed as a low interest rate money. They're being given that money at effectively 0%, and then loaning it out to credit card borrowers who are willing, you know, those that are willing to take it at, you know, 9, 11, 15, 17%. how come the bank gets to make all that profit after years and years of profit and one oopsie, and the consumer gets to be in more and more and more debt as a result?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much wrong with your story other than I think that the banks made years and years of oopsie and the bill finally came due. And the bill that came due for their years and years of oopsie was big enough that it could have made them deadsy. And that fear of having the private banking system collapse in some sort of systematic way left the government at a crossroads here in the country. And they basically had two choices: bail out the banks and hope that their profit motive aligns with the social and macroeconomic requirement that they continue loaning, which we tried, or nationalize them, which we more or less refused to try. And so we've now embarked on the strangest hybrid program I think the world has ever seen, in which we took a bunch of money and bailed out our private banks. This would be taxpayer money. And basically the banks still aren't lending anywhere near enough. So at the same time, on a parallel track, we have been aggressively turning the Federal Reserve System and a little bit the Treasury Department into a national bank, but we never call it that, so we feel okay. So we sort of nationalized through the Federal Reserve and Treasury a lot of what banks are supposed to do while bailing out our banks, which kind of aren't doing that because they're not much in a position to. And in the big picture, the view from 20,000 feet or what have you, the problem is that for American banks to do what the macro economy needs right now is very dangerous to the survival of American banks, because that would mean to take big risks on loaning more money to highly indebted and in many cases borderline solvent American households in order to buoy the economy.
But isn't that what they're trying to promote by making all this credit available?
That's what the Federal Reserve is trying to promote, because that's what's in the better public good. Because if we have a credit seizure in the midst of a recession, which we now have, then you're going to have a worse recession and a worse credit seizure. The problem is that the banks still have huge risks because they still have to wait and see how much of the trillions in loans they've given out in the last, say, 5 or 6 years particularly are going to be paid back either in only in part or only in part and late, or in some cases not at all. So they still have many more months of significant losses to go. And if they loan out the cash they have now and they make bigger losses than they expected, they'll be insolvent again in 6 months. And worse yet, if they loan out a lot of money now and they take big losses, and then a lot of the money they're loaning out now to the U.S. public also doesn't come back or comes back only partially or comes back late, then they'll be in at least an equally bad solvency crisis again 12 months from now. And rather schizophrenically, the federal government has told them, here's some cheap or free money, loan, loan, loan. But by the way, if you loan too much and your books are too weak, will seize you and sell you really cheap to your competitors whose balance sheets are stronger. And this has left a situation where banks were primarily interested in hoarding cash, which was terrible for the economy, buying each other really cheap when somebody else was in worse shape than you, because you could get government assistance to buy them out to prevent a bankruptcy. And right now, what I think the banks and investors are doing is busy basically buying the mortgage-backed securities that the federal government says it's going to buy, and so that they can make a huge profit and siphon off some more of the TARP money that's coming. And so the banks and the federal government's attempt to manage a macroeconomic downturn are a bit at cross purposes, or at least are not pulling together in the present moment. And that's left us in a sort of schizophrenic situation where the government is pumping out money at a rapid rate, and it's not really creating a situation where people have as easy a time getting credit as they would like to and as we need them to push up the level of purchasing in the economy right now.
So let's talk a little bit more about the spiral of deflation and how deflation then impacts an economy, and basically what's the relationship between deflation and recession? Are they always coupled, and how do they feed on each other? What's the difference?
Well, they tend to be coupled, recessions and deflations, and they do tend to feed on each other, in part because both inflations and deflations are very much influenced by their own set of expectations, and that gives you a snowball effect. Let me give you an idea. If people fear a recession, even before it has arrived, they may begin to start to hoard money. They decide to not buy things, but to save money because they're afraid about their economic future or their job security or their pensions or any number of things. If they begin to do this, then they don't spend and they hoard money. Their not spending means that more and more unsold inventories of goods and services build up. And the people who rely on their spending to make a living become desperate to get them to spend. And the way they try to lure or induce the spending out of these weary or concerned consumers is by cutting prices. So if you cut a lot of prices, that's deflation. Then what happens, of course, is consumers begin to expect falling prices and they wait to buy things.
But before you go there, so is deflation only falling prices? Because what about this issue of money velocity? I mean, isn't...
Well, that would show up. I mean, if people start to hoard their money, then the velocity of money would fall because they would be building up more cash and or borrowing less. And that would mean that any amount, any money stock, any supply of money that we had in the economy would be turning over less. And that would be indicated by a lower velocity, and that would quickly influence the amount of economic activity. Stores don't call and order replacement inventory when they haven't sold the inventory in their warehouses and on their shelves.
So the thing that the government is facing, even if it does do a huge amount of infrastructural spending, Keynesian stimulus, if you will, the problem they're facing is if they're spending that money and creating demand and dollars are being pumped into the economy at the same time, if the people who are getting that work and getting that money still won't spend as much and people still have a pessimistic view about the future, it doesn't have the, quote, pump priming effect that's desired. It doesn't jumpstart things.
Well, it would still probably do some good over if they hadn't done anything. But yes, it vastly dilutes and diminishes the potency and the power of government spending if the wages that are spent out for the workers, the profits that are doled out to the companies if they use private contractors, and that appears to be the plan at this point, if that money is then either hoarded as savings and then not lent out to someone else or spent on imported goods because they're cheaper and the public is hunting for the best deals, then the potency, effectiveness, and, you know, let's say recession-fighting power of the government infrastructure plan is vastly reduced, which means the government would have to spend a lot more money to get a lot less increase in economic activity.
So we've got this lovely economic system where if people behave in a rational and prudent way, it's immensely destructive to the system. But if they're profligate, if they're not paying attention to their debt load, if they're just saying, hey, you know, things are going to be great tomorrow, let's go spend, that's healthy, that's wonderful, that's good. And right now there's an attempt to encourage people to take that attitude. So what kind of economic system do we have?
There's something called the paradox of thrift here, right? It depends a little bit on how the economy is based. So the paradox of thrift is that for a country overall, and certainly for an individual or a household, savings are very important in order to build up a pool of loanable funds in the society that can be used by people who need or want to borrow, and also so that people have some sort of safety net or cushion against what are really the violent oscillations, the up and down, the ebb and flow of a market capitalist society. So on the one hand, there's both social value to savings, they're important, and individual personal or household value to savings, quite important as a sort of protection and as a way to, you know, buffer or shield yourself from the violent swings of the economy. But paradoxically, if people save too much or suddenly increase their saving, it sends shockwaves through the economy. Because the single most important feature of a modern economy is interdependence. Each person's actions affect everyone else's actions in an endless feedback loop. And so if there's a sudden change in the way people behave, it sends shockwaves through the system. And if everybody does what's rationally best for them in a downturn, they make any recession longer and deeper. And that's why you need, theoretically, in this system, an agent that doesn't act in its own rational best interest, but acts to save the system from the impulses of the system and we hope to and look to the federal government to provide that role. I understand this is a strange thing to say because we've just spent 30 years chastising the government for not doing a good job of acting in its own narrow sense of self-interest. But what was left out of a lot of those discussions is that if the government really does act only in its narrow self-interest, the ship goes down.
But what does it even mean to say the government's acting in its narrow self-interest? You know, you can attack the government as being inefficient or wrong-headed or open to political influence, but at the end of the day, it is representing the huge diversity of interests that are present in the economy, and the economy is not a natural thing. It's an artificial thing created by a system of regulations and rules.
Yeah, absolutely. The economy is not a natural thing. It's a human construct. It's a subject to and open to change. And in fact, the history of economies is the history of sometimes slow and gradual and other times violent and purposeful change. And on some level, it's quite arbitrary.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was my feeling is that over the last 30 years, the huge capital stores built up in the American economy over the preceding 30 years, basically since World War II, have just been hollowed out. So the all the spending that we've been doing and all the money that's been changing hand and all the economic activity has really been driven by mobilizing sunk capital and not so much by the creation of a new value in an economy. And what we're dealing with now is this kind of hangover where, you know, we were basically spending down an inheritance, so to speak, and now it's gone. And so we're going to have to spend less because we didn't use that inheritance to build things. We just spent it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I would make maybe a slightly different point. I would say that to some extent, we saw perhaps a period of the 80s, 70s and 80s as living off the past wealth and productive capacity that the country had built up, let's say in the century before that, from the 1870s to the 1970s or something. And a lot of the last 10 years particularly has been not just living off your savings, because we really kind of ran out of savings, but living by consuming now against future income and future earnings. And that was really excessive. I mean, the easiest way to do this example is just to look at the government. From 1783 to 2001, the U.S. government ran up a cumulative net total of about $5 trillion in debt. From 2001 to 2008, we more than doubled it. So we doubled the government debt in basically 7 years. We did as much debt spending as a government as we had done in the preceding 220 some years. That's pretty flabbergasting type of stuff.
Well, not really. I mean, that's an exponential function with what, a 7 or 8% growth rate, or is it 10% is doubling in 7 years? I should know this. But it's the nature of an exponential process. It's the same thing in human population. When you're in the exponential part of the growth curve, you get doublings, and so it's always the case that in whatever the recent doubling period, you've created more than was created in all of prior history. And
sure,
if
you get into a dynamic of spending where your debt is autonomously exponentially growing, that's called a solvency trap. And very quickly, you become insolvent. In terms of macroeconomic management, when you get into a position where an accurate description of the relationship between your spending and your income trips out in that particular along that particular growth pattern, you are in a solvency trap that you either end the dynamic quickly or you become insolvent. So it has within it an existential threat.
You're going to have to slow down and explain that to me again, because I have the sense that something in there is important, but it's new to me and I don't quite get it. One more time. A solvency trap is what?
Sure. There's two different things, right? So one is just the relationship between the numbers, right?
And just so anybody who's not comfortable with math understands, an exponential process is one in which the rate of growth is dependent on how big whatever's growing is at the time. So that is, the bigger it gets, the faster it gets bigger, and actually the faster the speed of getting bigger increases. So as far down as you want to drill. So things are accelerating, basically.
Exactly. The problem being that this isn't just a description of numbers, right? So it's not a theoretical exercise. What we're actually discussing is the U.S. government debt, right? If you reach a situation where your spending so exceeds your income that your debt, the difference, the cumulative difference between your spending and your income, begins to grow in an exponential or sort of self-expanding pattern, you are insolvent. Because unless you structurally reorganize the relationship between your spending and your income, the only place you can go is into deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper debt until either nobody will lend to you or you default. And that makes this an insolvency spiral. It means that if you stay on the trajectory that you're going on, it will end badly. It's, in other words, refusing to get off a highway, having seen the sign coming up that highway ends, highway under construction, missing portion of bridge, highway incomplete, alert, alert, road closed. And you look at that and you say, let's jump it. And you have your Dukes of Hazzard financial planning and you try to jump the ravine.
Because you've got this financial planner or your CNBC anchor person next to you in the car saying, but pay no attention, pay no attention. Spend.
Look, it's always true that we don't know when debt becomes unsustainable, because in order to figure out the sustainability of a debt situation, you have to know the answer to all kinds of economic questions.
Like what?
And people's attitudes. And you can't, in other words, at what point do people stop lending to a deadbeat? Not clear. How much can the government bail itself out? Not clear. The more rapid the economic growth, the more government tax revenues can increase. So how much can we grow our income in the future, the government's income through taxes? Not clear. How much scope is there to raise taxes? Well, that has something to do with the economy. It has a lot to do with politics and people's opinion about whether or not they're willing to pay for taxes, right? How much will it cost us to be this much in debt in the future? Will it cost us much more? Will it cost us much less? In other words, there's a lot of range here, and no one can be sure. But what we can be sure is that the more indebted you are and the more rapidly growing your debt is, the more certainly you are approaching a situation where the debt becomes unshoulderable as a burden, and that becomes a solvency crisis.
Well, this leads to the other question that this same listener, actually a broadcaster, Lynn Geary of Unwelcome Guests, asked, which is, isn't the economic system as a whole then a Ponzi scheme? I mean, there's all this discussion about Bernard Madoff, but isn't structurally our financial system a Ponzi scheme?
Large segments of our financial system, much larger than Madoff Capital or Bernie Madoff's activity, have aspects that are, let's say, eerily similar to a Ponzi scheme. And I would say that part of the reason people are so enraptured and enthralled by Madoff, and obviously him and his firm did steal an enormous amount of money, and particularly from all kinds of charities and sort of socially good organizations, which is quite upsetting legitimately on its own. But part of the reason there's so much attention is because the country has spent the last 16 months discovering a lot of what we thought was sure and solid was a variety of different Ponzi schemes made possible only by our faith in those schemes. And as soon as we were willing and able or forced to begin to ask questions about these sure things and great ideas, they evaporated. You know, what was seen as solid became liquid or gaseous very quickly, and that left people fundamentally rattled. And Bernie Madoff is yet another extremely painful reminder of how many of the solid things we thought we could rely on in our society were basically faith-based initiatives with little hard scientific or concrete backing.
So we've been dealing with an economic system for a number of years that seemed normal, and now we've had this sudden shock and people are rattled. But I still think that habit is a very powerful force, even if you discover that, you know, all the things that formed the foundation of your behavior were illusory. So
absolutely. Look, we're about $1 trillion or so into what will certainly be a very painful multi-trillion-dollar effort to save ourselves from an excessive debt housing bubble economy by pumping more debt into the American economy and trying to resuscitate housing.
And
so I couldn't
isn't
see
it
a better example of exactly what you're talking about than our response to the crisis, which is an effort to rebuild the bubble.
Right. That's
as
the point.
A solution to the bursting of the bubble, which is not probably the best, most stable, sane, sustainable long-term solution.
And so it seems like, you know, there's going to have to be a transformation in the way people think so that they recognize that what they thought was normal was not only not normal, but actually bizarre. And then you go to this question of values, which is why the title is Money and Values. And by the way, anybody who wants to listen to prior episodes or and see postings we've done or hopefully get involved in a conversation can go to our blog at moneyandvalues.net. That's moneyandvalues.net. But it goes to this question of, well, what are your values? I mean, what kind of economic choices are you making and why? How are they driven? In the recent period, a lot of people made the economic choice to go into finance because there was a ton of money to be had there. But it was just a paper trading game that just went bluey. And so it seems to me that we've got to undergo some sort of major structural shift that's related to a shift in perception. And I'm wondering what you think about how that's going to proceed and how it relates to the current state of deflation and recession.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. The United States needs a structural alteration in its economy.
Just the U.S., or are we talking globally?
It's very much true globally as well, because the United States, again, interdependence is the single most important facet of a modern economy. So it's true that workers and consumers and government agencies and corporations are highly interdependent in the United States on one level, but every bit is true. The U.S. workers, consumers, governments, and enterprises are very much interdependent with their counterparts around the world and each other around the world. So it's certainly a global issue. And the United States is still 21-22% of global GDP. So what's true of America is true of 25% of the world's economic activity still. So nothing is just going to be an issue only in America, right? So yeah, it's a global issue. But basically, in the best opportunity in a really serious downturn, which is what we have now, is to do the hard work of facing up to what was going wrong and restructuring the economy to not have those problems going forward. That's what needs to be done. That's what I hope will be done, and it's possible it will be.
So how is that done?
Well, I'll tell you how it isn't done. It isn't done by trying to figure out how to roll back the clock to 3 or 4, or for that matter, 30 years ago, and set up the same problem we have now, traveling back in time, always a reactionary impulse, and trying to get back to the bubble, because it signals, if you try to do that, it signals that you don't understand that the bubble creates the bursting of the bubble. The bubble actually is the problem, right? That's the disease. The bursting of the bubble is just the symptom. And I am not particularly excited by what looks to me like a lot of high-level policymaking, which is designed to say, okay, how can we keep people in homes they can't afford? How can we keep people buying cars they don't need and can't afford? And how can we? I mean, some short-term triage and emergency medical response is required, right? And not to overdo the analogy, but if you get a patient with a heart attack, you do have to defibrillate the patient. You do have to do whatever you can to keep the patient alive, because changing the lifestyle of a dead person is a poor investment and unlikely to be successful.
Yeah, I guess
but
so.
But as soon as you stabilize the patient and get them out of the immediate existential crisis, you know, where they could die, you need to begin to work on a different lifestyle, right? Ideally, you don't just pump them full of drugs and give them a defibrillator to take home so they can shock their heart again back when it stops beating. What you want to do is tell them, this is a lifestyle with more exercise and a different diet and yada, 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 which will reestablish your life in a way so that the everyday function of your life doesn't cause your heart to stop functioning.
Yeah, but where that analogy breaks down is that there are a bunch of people in the economy or a bunch of actors that are about to have heart attacks. They haven't had their heart attack yet. So this cascade of defaulting debt is going to be wiping lots of people out. And it's kind of a political problem because a lot of the people who are going to be wiped out have in the past had a great deal of political power attached to the amount of money that was flowing through their hands. So
And when possible, you want to front run, get in front of, and ameliorate or prevent the heart attack bankruptcy scenario. But if you can't do it, if their continued function in the way they used to be functioning is killing the economy, then you're much better off not saving their bad function for the overall economy, but helping them to relocate and reposition themselves so that they can be part of a sustainable and growing economy that's healthy and isn't afflicted with this internal crisis tendency.
Well, that goes to the sort of the second half of the question I wanted to ask you about, which was the relationship between money and actually productive capital. Because in order to get healthy, an economy has to become productive of real of things of real value. And our economy, our here, meaning the U.S. economy, it seems to me for many years has not been based primarily on creating new value. Although I think in the tech sector, people can say, hey, that's a whole bunch of great new things that didn't exist before. But
I think you could say that about bioscience as well and pharmaceutical industry. I mean, there are a bunch of industries that have made significant new techniques of production, significant new kinds of goods and services available to the global public.
Yeah, but a lot of that also has to do with taking things that previously weren't monetized and just monetizing them. I mean, a lot of,
sure.
For example, bioscience is just about developing things that are ownable. You know, plant crops or genetic sequences or things like that. So you create things, new things that can be owned. But leaving aside the fact that a lot of what appears to be the creation of new value is actually just the creation of new ownable things that may or may not improve the quality of anyone's life. The point is that it's certainly true that it's become largely, the U.S. economy has become largely a service economy as opposed to a manufacturing economy. And so I guess the basic question is, how does an economy get restructured so it's primarily focused on building value in a long-term way after a period where it's been about extracting previously created value?
Well, the way it, there's sort of two broad ways that an economy can be restructured. One is that you can hope and pray and bet and wish that the functions of a market rewarding what is quote-unquote useful or slash desirable and punishing what's quote-unquote useless or not desirable weeds out the unproductive or not desired portions of the economy, strengthens and rewards the more valuable parts of the economy through some sort of Darwinian market process. No guarantees there, and the time frame of transition can be so long as to create violent political reactions.
Yeah, but the economy we've had has rewarded speculation pretty much, and it's a largely speculative system now.
Sure, well, we've become, I mean, that's a sort of a related but not identical issue, which is what we've been classifying as economic growth and celebrating as the success of the American economy for a lot of the last 20 years or so has been largely redistribution, debt, and speculation. And those have become pillars of our economy, which we've celebrated.
And there's always some redistribution going on. Specifically, what kind of redistribution are you talking about?
Yeah, there's always redistribution. Changes in prices and changes in basic economic structure always create redistribution. You're absolutely right. But in the last 30 years, we've watched the largest upward wealth redistribution ever seen anywhere in the developed world without a violent revolution take place. So while there's always redistribution and distributional issues, we have seen a speed, an intensity, and a massivity of redistribution from the, say, bottom 80% of the country to the top 5% of the country by income and wealth that has actually a relatively small number of historical parallels, and it's quite dramatic.
And the thing that I've always thought about that, the reason they haven't had a revolution or we haven't had a revolution here is that I think most Americans have been convinced that they have the opportunity to be on the winner's side of that redistribution and also, you know, trained to sort of identify with the people who won the game as the people who deserve to win. So
absolutely. I'd add something to it, too, though, because I think that part of the reason we haven't had more political upset, a huge part of it is the culture of celebrating success, that everybody has a right to be there, and nobody wants to see the chance to be wildly rich taken away before particularly they get to be there and experience that.
Right.
They or their kids or their grandkids, depending on how they conceive these things. But a major part of the reason we didn't seem more upset about that was that the absolute wealth in the country was so unusually high and widespread that the material quality of life that a lot of Americans had remained unusually good for a long time.
Yes, Stan Goff has said that the problem with the U.S. public was that it was structurally indoctrinated by its own level of comfort.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way of looking at it, right? So materially, even if you were relatively less well off, your absolute material standard of living was actually doing pretty decently. Maybe not fabulous, and it depends on how you account for the fact that people were under massive and growing stress, working more and more hours on more and more jobs with less and less vacation.
And less security and more health care. More liability in terms of what a health problem was going to cost them.
The problem is that this rising standard of living was achieved in the United States by working yourself ragged, quite literally, taking no time off, starting work younger, ending work older, and taking less time off in between, which has its own stresses, strains, and problems. But it was also significantly accomplished, the rising standard of living, by burning through your savings and then going massively into debt.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we've reached such a dangerous crossroads in the country is that Americans cannot continue to go forward through dis-savings and increasing their debt level for more than maybe a few more years. And even if we do succeed in finding a way to do it for a few more years, you know, maybe 5 or 6 at the maximum, that will only delay and increase the collapse that will come.
Well,
we really do need to refound the economy. People need to make enough money to live and to basically not rely in some sort of long-term structural sense on dis-savings and debt, because you can't sustainably rely on dis-saving and debt for more than a short period of time, and we have already overdone it.
Well, so this brings me to this question of what does money represent? Because you and I had a discussion offline a little while ago about whether or the conditions under which money actually represents a kind of capital. And by capital, I mean something that is a foundation that allows you to produce something.
Sure. I mean, if you take a notion of productive capital and then you take a notion of money, you have to add to it a notion of money capital. Not all money is capital.
So could you expand on that a little?
Sure. I mean, depending on which economic theory you use, because there's more than one economic theory, and the agreement is not uniform across them. But in order to be capital, money has to be part of a process in which its value expands through the addition of labor and machinery and raw materials, equipment, right? If it's just money, then money is just a store of value or a means of exchange, right? It can store value, and it can be used as a measuring stick to measure the value of things.
It can store value as long as there aren't a bunch of financial games going around that can blow up whatever that supposed value is.
Sure, it will only store value accurately with a stable price level. So anything that destabilizes the price level up through inflation or down through deflation wreaks havoc on money's ability to store value.
So,
but with a stable price level, money can measure value. It can be a means of exchange. It can allow people to make exchanges, and it can store value. But that's about it. And the only way money becomes productive is if it's used in a productive process. If money is used to go out there and, you know, I don't know, for example, lease a workshop and buy some machines and track down and interview and hire a bunch of skilled laborers and bring them in there and combine the raw materials, the machine and the workspace and the skilled labor to produce a good or service. And then you're only solvent if you can sell that good or service for at least as much as it cost you to produce it.
So don't you want out of a financial regulatory system, let's leave aside the discussion about capitalism or state-sponsored corporate capitalism versus other economic systems, but if you just wanted an economic system that led to the creation of more benefit more things of actual value to people. Wouldn't you want to punish the hell out of, and by that I mean tax the hell out of, any activity that is not directed towards a productive goal? And
Historically, you often do. I mean, historically, in states or periods that are really, really focused on maximizing the amount of goods and services, particularly goods that they produce, often in heavy industry, they usually do what's sometimes referred to in the industry as cage the banking system. So you make the financial system nothing other than a weak servant of industry. And then you say, okay, yeah, of course we need to make some loans and change currencies from one currency to another and maybe sell some bonds and maybe even a little bit of stocks and invest some insurance premium. But this is going to be done to the limited, most limited extent possible under heavy regulation and really, really intense supervision by various potent regulatory authorities. And you make the financial system a subservient appendage to industry.
But then isn't the, you know, finance industry counterargument to that, that, well, that can stifle innovative new projects, because what you're ending up doing is actually restricting the flow of capital, and in this crazy money party we've had, anybody could have gotten credit to start a new business. And so while we may have a shock in these rapidly changing values, a whole lot of things got started that never would have got started in a tightly controlled system of the sort you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always the counter argument. The other counter argument that could be made about the United States was, by the time we began to sort of super financialize our economy, we had already begun to structurally and systematically lose the competitive industrial struggle to other parts of the world, particularly some countries in Western Europe and East Asia, so maybe most sort of notably in early Germany and Japan. And so what was happening wasn't that we built up a financial system which killed our industrial sector. It's that our industrial sector proved to be less of a global competitive leader while our financial system was taking off and was a global leader. And so we refocused all our energies into the area in which we had dominance and leadership, more or less things financial, and that contributed to the continued, although pre-existing, decline of heavy industry and manufacturing.
I think it was in a book of Kevin Phillips that I read that's a common feature of the late stage of empire. It's happened to many empires. You get a transition from the activities that made the empire powerful into finance, and then that's the sort of signal that you're on the decline.
Yeah, that's often been true. The idea there often being that at some point you reach a sort of apex, right, which is a peak of an empire, after which you go into a decline, and the decline is marked by trying to extort through tribute, manipulation, and speculation the increasingly unsustainable cost of your empire from its subjects until you reach a point where there's simply no way for you to fund this giant operation whose basic productive apparatus is insufficient to its cost.
I think about it in biological terms, where if you get a whole lot of, you know, biologically valuable resources in one place, you better have one hell of an immune system, because otherwise, you know, parasites are gonna take all that energy back, so to speak. And I personally think of all this financial speculatory activity as a kind of parasitism that overwhelms, you know, the productive activities of an economy.
Yeah, it can be. It can certainly be extremely parasitic. It's also worthy of note that modern finance can also be very enabling to industry, right? So there's always a delicate balance between the financial sector and the industrial sector, because the financial sector can be a very important enabling competitive advantage to heavy industry. And it's virtually impossible to have any modern industrial sector without a pretty advanced financial sector, without at least a functional financial sector. However, you know, rather in a contradictory way, the financial system can also outgrow, dominate, and suck the life out of an industrial sector.
Right.
And look, an industrial sector can do that to a financial sector. You can be so excited about producing things that you lose touch with the fact that in a market economy, that's only worth doing if you can sell them for a profit, vastly overproduce goods and services which you can't sell, force the banks to loan money to these industrial companies, which they may even own the banks or maybe more powerful than the banks, and then get a situation where you've bankrupted the banks and the industrial companies, massively overproducing things for which there's no market, no demand.
Well, that's the role of the propaganda system or mass media, if you will, which is to stoke demand and to make sure that, you know, there's consumption going on.
Sure. At all times, at all costs.
Right. And so that goes to the question of what your values are, because that's how you arrive at a world in which consumption becomes the primary value, because the whole economic system is being driven by the need to maintain the perception of need or, you know, consumer demand, no matter how much you produce. So you get into a psychotic cycle of consumption and desire.
Consumption breeds overconsumption. There may be one other point worth making, which is that consumption has come in the American experience to be synonymous with quality of life. And that isn't really altogether healthy, and it isn't necessary. So in other words, quality of life isn't really just how much and how often you consume goods and services, right? I think it's a little bit more nuanced and complex than that. And part of the top-out boom of overconsumption that we've had, like the debt and the social imbalance and the international imbalances that we know a lot about, has been this sense that you have to consume huge and growing quantities of everything all the time, or your life is a disaster of a terrible quality and maybe not fully worth living. And that's a strange ideological and cultural perversion, which is terrible for the environment, the ecological environment, probably unhealthy politically and unsustainable on so many levels that re-exploring and changing that is probably a priority on which an enormous number of people in some way or another could agree. And the opportunity to do that, even if you're forced to do it by an economic downturn, now presents itself, and it would be quite sad if it couldn't be somehow seized and discussed and decided upon.
Well, to me, the most valuable things are time and space. I'd like to live in a place where I have room to stretch out, and I'd like to have the time to enjoy, you know, the relationships of life and all the interesting things that life could hold. But time is something that it's very hard to get free, because everybody needs to work. I mean, most people in this economy are under such pressure to work in order to get a sense of actually stable security, which, you know, this psychotic consumption-driven economy doesn't provide anybody. In fact, insecurity is a very important driver. So you, just like eating fast food, you know, you consume electronic equipment or you consume, you know, all sorts of media stimuli or games or things like that to keep yourself jazzed, when what you really don't have is that sense of peace, stability, and security that would let you enjoy other aspects of a life.
Well, also, if more is always what you have, you will never have enough.
Yeah. Well, I know we don't have much time left in today's show, but I do want to at least touch on something that maybe we can pursue in future shows, which is this idea of using monetary policy and fiscal policy to, and that means, you know, what's monetary policy, what's the Fed doing, what's the price of money, fiscal policy, what's the government doing to stimulate the economy, et cetera. So do you think is going to be the impact of pumping a bunch of money into an economy where the economy isn't sort of poised to do something much more productive with it?
Well, I think that pumping the amount of money we did in was an emergency measure, which will do one of two things. If it's coordinated with very carefully and creatively applied fiscal policy, which means government spending on providing goods and services and hiring people, then it'll have stalled the further progression of the crisis and bought us the breathing room to come up with good, creative, new, honest, efficient projects for the government. If that is not the route that our future fiscal policy spending goes, then we will have a massive government budget deficit, a weak economy, and too many dollars in circulation. You'll see the U.S. dollar fall against other global currencies. You'll see basic materials that Americans buy from around the world, heavily, oil being one that comes to mind, although not the only one, shoot up in prices for America, for American consumers and American businesses, and you will see a terrible stagflation, by which I mean stagnant or shrinking economy with persistently weak labor markets, hard to get a job, hard to keep a job, hard to get paid enough at work, with rising prices. And that will be cataclysmic for some of the same people who limped out of the last year and the next year or two's economic downturn, still in middle-class condition. So if you get it wrong, if it's sort of make-work policy with lots of pork barrel spending and the same old, then we really will be administering a medicine to the patient that makes the patient sicker, because it'll be based on a misdiagnosis. And that is a scary sort of worst case scenario.
As this proceeds, what are the things to watch that will answer the question, how do we know which of those paths we're running down? How do you know?
I think you'd have to watch for something that's really creative and makes sense. If we're going to invest hundreds of billions, or actually quite clearly now, at least somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion or more dollars in public spending, which I'm not opposed to, by the way, I think you need to do it in ways that change the way America functions to make America a healthier and more productive society. Because that way, even if the projects don't produce as much economic growth as people want them to, always a distinct possibility, they will at least leave us a better off, stronger, and more united people. And that argues strongly for serious investments in education and healthcare, by which I don't mean repainting the schools and giving every kid a notebook computer. I mean changing the way American kids are schooled so that the dropout rates fall and that the educational experience changes and that America takes this moment, this opportunity, to go from being a global education laggard, which we are, shamefully, to a global education leader. And I think in our healthcare, we need to combine healthcare and food and nutrition. And I think we need to work toward having an understanding of what we eat as part of our medicine, sort of, as part of our basic education, and use that to provide universal health care with a massive emphasis on lifestyle, preventative care, and nutrition. We do those kind of things, even if they don't give us as much economic growth as we want, they'll make us a stronger, more equal, more united, healthier, and more educated country. And I don't think there's been that many episodes in human history where people look back and say, you know what? I just wish we hadn't wasted so much money being educated and healthy. What a bust.
Yeah.
Right? But you could have that situation with other big projects, like lots of bridges and fancy new technology in a school where the kids haven't eaten, don't have a stable home and can't read, but everybody has a $1,800 notebook computer.
And I'll just add one other thing to your prescription, which is, it's very physical activity is a very big part of health. So you can
Absolutely.
You can eat well, but if you're not moving, you're not going to be healthy. Your body was meant to move, and actually, a gentleman named Levine from the Mayo Clinic has done a lot of excellent work showing that the epidemic in obesity isn't so much an epidemic of food consumption, although that's an important element of it, but it's actually an epidemic of inactivity. So as we close out 2008, let me just say to everybody listening that I hope you were listening on your portable MP3 player and taking a walk. And if you weren't, maybe it's time to get up and move around, spend time with your family, and hopefully think about the things that each of us is going to be doing in the coming years to create things that are really valuable instead of just to play with paper.
I hope that in 2009, we have a more active critique of our leadership and our economy, a more active lifestyle, and a more active search for solutions than we've had 2008.
All right. Well, that's a good place to end it, I think, today. And hopefully we'll be talking about that in 2009. You've been listening to Money and Values, a program about the changing value, but more importantly, about the changing nature of money. My name's Dave Adelson. I've been speaking to Max Frod-Wolf. The program is licensed under a Creative Commons 3.0 share alike attribution non-commercial license. And our theme song is Money Money from Marcus Thrower, available online at archive.org and the Open Source Audio Collection. I hope everybody has a great end of this crazy year and a great 2009. Thanks a lot, Max, for taking the time.
Me too. Happy New Year to everyone and to you. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, man.
I need it. So I just get so I can stack. I want it. Money, everything.